desk. The doctor can make of that what he likes. He writes something on his notepad. He writes and writes. He doesn't look up and he doesn't speak. I wonder if he's trying to get something down before he forgets it. There are little bean-like things lying on the desk, round and soft, their shoots curling off under a box of tissues. I can't think what you call them, but I know what they're for. I pick one up and hold it to my ear, but I can't hear anything. Not even as good as a shell, I say.
I haven't got the player on at the moment, the doctor says, still scribbling. Would you like to hear some music? Do you think that would help you?
I don't know.
Perhaps your daughter could find something you like. What did you used to listen to as a girl?
Ha 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 ha, I say. The doctor looks up from his writing. Helen goes very still. Ha 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 ha! Mum, what's happening?
She reaches out and grips my arm, her face white beneath her weather-beaten skin.
And now I'm really laughing. It's the champagne aria, I say.
It was Douglas's record, the champagne aria, sung by Ezio Pinza. I liked his name and I liked the song, but I liked the laughing at the end best. It was one of the first records Douglas played to us, long before Suki was married. The very first was John McCormack singing Come Into the Garden, Maud, and it amused me because it had my name in it. But I'd already been forced to memorize the words to the poem at school, and I was keener on discovering less familiar songs. We had seen Douglas's gramophone amongst his belongings when he was moving in, and after a lot of pestering from me, Suki finally asked if we could come into his room and hear it. It seemed a completely different room with Douglas living there. We'd always had a lodger, but they'd been old ladies for the most part. Kind enough, but somehow hardly leaving an impression on the place. Douglas had few possessions, but they were more solid than the old ladies' things had been. A set of books, a set of tools, and at least 2 dozen records. The gramophone was just a little portable machine, like a deep attaché case, but I thought it was quite fantastic. I particularly liked the little tin of needles and the round sort of brush for the records and the way the handle fitted into a clip in the lid. We sat in his room to listen, the sunlight lining the floorboards and soaking the rug. Once I'd heard it, I made him play the champagne aria several times in a row, and I lay on the rug laughing along with the end, hands on my stomach, feeling my diaphragm jerk. I remember the smell of the warm dust and the vinegar which Ma had used to wash the floorboards. I still have the record somewhere. Douglas left it for me, but I haven't heard it in a long time. We don't have a gramophone, so there's nothing to play it on. After that first private concert, I used to sneak into Douglas's room occasionally to listen to records. I knew his rounds as well as I knew Dad's, and I had the route by heart, from the dairy on Sutton Road, down past the station to the clifftop hotels. I knew when he was furthest away and when he wouldn't be able to pop back unexpectedly. I used to push bundled pairs of woolen socks into the horn to muffle the volume, play the aria again, and feel my diaphragm jump under my hands. I did that often while I was still recovering from my illness, after Suki disappeared. And I used to search through his other belongings, too, opening drawers and rifling through his things. Having seen him search Suki's case, I thought it was only fair. But his clothes were neatly folded, the books carefully ordered with nothing slipped between the pages, and I couldn't find anything peculiar. Once, though, on the way out of the room, after I'd brushed my fingers over the gramophone and poked in the little needle tin and gone through the set of Dickens, I saw an umbrella propped up in the corner of the room, a shabby black umbrella. It was so much like the one the mad woman had, and the memory of her chasing me was still so vivid that I screamed. I felt very stupid immediately afterwards and left the room, glad that no one was at home to catch me. Katie's brought a flat silver computer with her. Its mass of wires stick out like an uncared-for shrub hastily planted in the middle of the kitchen table. She fusses about with speakers and other things, trying to get them to work, and I try to focus on the booklet in my hand. It's got pictures of brains and simple, thick-lined drawings of old people leaning on each other and smiling. I know I'm supposed to read it, make sense of it, but I can't concentrate. There's a new loaf in the bread bin. "Mum thought you'd like to hear some old music," Katie says, pushing the teeth of a plug into the wall. She clicks a button, and Vera Lynn blasts out, making "Meeting Again" sound like some kind of threat. "Good God," I say, covering my ears. "Sorry." Katie quickly jabs at a button, lowering the volume. "There. How about that? Does it jog any memories?" "Not really," I say, flicking through the pages of this little book. "It's not much of a story, and it's a bit unconventional for children. There are pictures that show someone's brain cut through. I don't think it's suitable for Katie, really, and I wonder if Helen knows what it's about."
"But it's nice to hear the song again," Katie asks.
I nod, and let my eyes drift back to the bread bin. Perhaps she wants me to tell her about the war. That would be a first. She's always stared into space when I've mentioned anything in the past. But there is something I wanted to ask her, or possibly Helen. I was waiting for Helen to arrive. I've underlined her name on my note, but I can't remember what it was about now. The song comes to an end, and I'm just about to suggest a piece of toast when the next one starts. The bread, soft with a crusty top, is ready sliced. But now I see there's a notice above it. No more toast. Katie is grinning at me, moving her head to the music. I sit still. I don't sigh. I don't roll my eyes. I look carefully at every page of the little book. But I don't think about it. I don't want to. I hate the sight of the squiggly lines spidering over the brains. And the word plaque makes me angry. I put the booklet under a sheet of newspaper.
"I think I've heard this song in a film," Katie says. "Or on an advert, maybe."
"Where's your mother?" I say. "I've something to tell her."
She's showing someone the house. But you're not supposed to know that."
"Showing them? What for?" I picture Helen unhinging the front of the house for huge people who peer in as if we were the borrowers. That's just what it was like with Douglas's house. When you walked past, you could look up and see the furniture and knick-knacks set out neatly. You could see him, too, sitting there in the half-room, drinking tea and listening to his gramophone. And Suki would be there, checking the time on the mantel clock.
"But how would they have got there?" I ask Katie.
"When the stairs had been blasted away." She turns the music up and looks intently at the screen of her computer.
"This is fun, isn't it? Mum said the doctor said she should play you music."
"So that's what this is about."
"Did he?"
I say. I nod, and it seems like the right response. But I never did like Vera Lynn. I remember reading once that she'd never had a singing lesson in her life. Doesn't surprise me. Lot of rubbish, her songs. Whoever heard of a bluebird at Dover? Anne Shelton was the one we liked best. You never hear her anymore. The music stops.
Grandma, Katie says, lot of rubbish. You can't say that about Vera Lynn.
She looks shocked, and I can't tell if she's serious.
I can't believe you don't like it.
Well, Katie, it's just...
You're a traitor to your generation, she says. Imagine if I didn't like, Girls Aloud or someone.
She gasps.
I don't like Girls Aloud. Am I a traitor to my generation too?
Now I know she's joking, and I start to smile.
I bet you don't even like watching Dad's Army, she says. I bet you just pretend to laugh at the jokes.
Don't deny it. I'm on to you now, Grandma. Two strangers appear at the top of the kitchen steps. They gaze down at us, nodding, as if we are part of the fittings.
Who are you?
I say. Helen pops up behind them, waving her hands, making some sort of sign. I can't tell what it's supposed to mean.
Anyway,
Katie suddenly says in a loud voice,
is there something you'd rather listen to? I can find anything.
She stretches her fingers over the computer's keyboard and makes a false sort of laugh. Something is going on.
Ezio Pinza, I say.
She looks at me blankly,
so I tell her about the champagne aria. I tell her about lying on the floor and the dust and sunlight.
The song is found easily in seconds, and Pinza's voice expands into the kitchen. Katie presses something that makes the song start again every time it ends, so that the laughing almost seems to come at the beginning of the song. And she lies on the floor at my feet.
Yes, I see what you mean, she says. It is fun. I'm not sure about you lying on the floor, though. We might never get you up again.
Strands of her hair mingle with a mess of crumbs, but she doesn't seem to care. And she does look a bit absurd, holding her hands over her stomach like that. I start to feel embarrassed for the child I once was. She closes her eyes, and I reach over the top of her head for a slice of bread. Katie doesn't seem to notice, and she doesn't notice when I get the butter out of the fridge. The sign says no toast, so I'll just have bread and butter. I can't think where the plates are for a moment, and there's no time to search. So I lay the bread on a sheet of the Daily Echo.
Ha-ha!
Katie says, hands on her stomach, as I get out a knife.
Ha-ha-ha!
As I'm digging a thick wedge out of the butter. Ha-ha-ha! As I run the side of my tongue along the soft, salty, buttery bread.
Ha-ha-ha!
I say, when I've finished. And I begin to squeeze the newspaper up into a ball, but it won't scrunch properly. There's some sort of booklet between the pages. The feel of the stiffer paper refusing to crumple makes me think of clearing out the range, of the sweet but unpleasant smell of prunes heating in gravy, of getting home after seeing Frank at the pub. I had heard the clock in the sitting room chiming five as I opened the kitchen door, and I thought I'd get a row when I walked in, but there was no one about. The range was alight, and Ma had left a note on the table saying she and Dad would be home at 6 o'clock and asking me to add a few potatoes to the hot pot. It was an amalgam of two different stews, one with prunes, and I wasn't particularly looking forward to it. The smell, as it started to warm up in the stove, was sweet and starchy, and I was glad Ma was out so I could help myself to something first. I cut a finger-thin slice off the loaf, and as Ma didn't like me to waste precious butter, I used the last of the margarine instead, putting a tiny knob of it onto a dish and sliding it into one of the warming ovens for a moment to soften it and make it go further. When I pulled it out again, several old sheets of newspaper came with it.
There was practically a whole Daily Echo, I thought, as I spread the marge on my bread and took a bite. Ma or I, having left a sheet there every time we'd laid something inside for keeping warm or softening. I began to wrap the spare sheets around the potato peelings on the table, but found there was a springy square inside which wouldn't crumple. It was the apple-stewed letter, the still-gummed envelope, brown at the edges. The address, to D. Weston at our house, was blurred but distinguishable, and I traced Suki's handwriting with my finger for a few moments without thinking. It was only as I was following the zigzag of the W again that I got a jolt. The words were readable. I checked the envelope several times in the days after I'd half-drowned it in the apples, peering between the sheets of paper while Ma's back was turned, but the address had been totally indecipherable, the ink just watery blotches. Whatever had been inside was lost, and the dismay had made me put it from my mind. Then what with collecting clues from the local streets, and being ill, and following Douglas, I'd forgotten it altogether. And somehow, those months of heat, the drying and browning and crisping of the paper, had made the words rise up again, blue, like a flame. I felt a balloon of hope inflate inside me. What if the letter had news of Suki? What if it told us where she'd gone? It seemed possible in that moment that she might have just gone away, ran off to be a pilot in Australia, or a mannequin in Paris, or anything. I crammed the rest of the bread and marge into my mouth and picked up the butter knife, slitting open the envelope as I chewed. The paper inside smelled strongly of apples where it had been soaked in the stewing fruit. But the words were readable. Doug? So sorry. So silly and wrong of me. So glad you wrote. Please let us be friends again. But I really must tell Frank. He will understand. I promise. Suki. I was still reading the words when Ma and Dad walked in. I pushed the paper into the pocket of my skirt, realizing at the same moment that Douglas was in the house. His gramophone was on upstairs, and the champagne aria was in my head. I wondered how long the music had been playing, how I hadn't noticed it before. The knowledge that Douglas had been nearby when I'd thought I was alone gave me a sudden chill, and I only half heard my parents tell me they'd been to see Frank. He was out of jail, they said, which of course I knew, though I kept quiet about meeting him, knowing Dad would have had a row with me for going into the pub.
"Course he wasn't at home when we got there," Dad said, "but we met him in the street on the way home. Tight. Which is hardly remarkable."
I felt a little nervous glow of secrecy at Dad's words. So, I thought, Frank hadn't stayed too long after I'd left, just long enough to get really drunk. I wondered if he'd gone home to have dinner or to get the nylons he'd promised that woman. "And what did he say?" I asked. Dad half-huffed, half-laughed in response.
"Says he thought Suki was staying with us."
He tapped at the edge of the sink.
"With her own house half a mile down the road. Can you credit it?"
Ma had her head turned away. Dad must have been going on and on all the way there and back. She'd probably had enough. 6 o'clock struck. The music on the floor above was silenced, and Douglas started down the stairs for dinner. I felt for Suki's letter inside my pocket. "So glad you wrote," she had written, as if she couldn't speak to Douglas directly any time she liked. As if there was something between them that had to be kept secret. I listened to his footsteps descending, light and uneven. Could he have been her lover? Was that possible? Even thinking the word lover seemed ridiculous. But I thought, didn't that explain everything? Suki's strange behaviour at that last dinner,
Frank's jealousy. The neighbour telling me that Douglas was at her house all the time. Perhaps even the broken records in the garden. She or Douglas might have smashed them in a fit of pique after they'd had a row. Let us be friends again. Ma looked in the oven to check the stew, and finding it was there and cooking, patted my arm. Dad sat down at the table without taking his overcoat off, and talked to the range more than us.
3 months and he doesn't think to check on his wife. I don't believe a word of it. And if he had to drive a load up to London, why did he come back on the train? That's what I don't understand. Where's the van he drove up in?
Douglas's steps had stopped in the hallway, and I could see him looking at himself in the mirror as I slid over the dresser to get forks and spoons and clear away the knife I'd used for the margarine. He was a nice-looking boy, Douglas, but he was just a boy. Even I could see that. It was too fantastic to think Suki might have loved him. Too fantastic. And yet, as I laid the table, I couldn't help feeling that the crinkling of the letter in my pocket was a kind of answer. Ma took the hot pot from the oven and sat down holding it in front of her as if she wasn't sure what to do with it now. I went and guided her hands to the table, taking the dishcloth and ladle in order to serve. "Unshaven, Frank was, and no collar," she said to me, letting her hands go limp. "I don't see how he can have become so dishevelled in so short a time. But I suppose that's jail for you. It must be hard, and the food's bad, I'm told. Course, it's not much better on the outside, with flour being put back on rationing. And now they say bread will be too. And there's no cooking fat in the tin, despite the tiny amounts I've been using. We're only halfway through the month, but we've got nothing left." She stared at the stew as I served it out, and I moved carefully, feeling the letter against my thigh as if it were as hot as the dish I was holding. Douglas still stood in front of the mirror, and I had a sudden idea that we were all of us standing behind some sort of glass wall, unable to reach each other anymore. Dad didn't move when I asked for his plate.
"Question is," he said, "did he take her to London with him? Or did something happen here?"
Chapter 13. "I wish you'd tell me what it is you want." Helen stands behind her car, one gardening glove on, calling from a distance, as if I were a dangerous animal. Apparently, I was very angry when she came near me earlier, and she has a pinch mark on her arm, which I'm trying not to notice. "I want the thing," I say, the tang of cut grass in my throat, the threads of leaves and green skin under my fingernails. "The other half of the thing that will lead me to..." It's gone. I fold a stalk over itself until it snaps. "Tell me. Tell me who it is. Who's missing, Helen? Who am I looking for?" She says Elizabeth's name. And hearing it is like falling into a soft bed. Bits. Bits fall from the stem of a hydrangea as I run my hand down it. I put some of the leaves into my pocket before weaving my arms amongst the flower heads, holding my breath against the sour milk smell of the sap. "Elizabeth," I say to the globe of petals. "Elizabeth." I throw empty stalks over the gouged lawn and then follow roots through the soil with my hands, pulling ragged, wool-like strands out, one after another. The rich feel of the earth is glorious, and the movement is soothing, until I get to a long, pale strand that won't budge. I tug it as far as I can, shaking it violently in frustration. And then I push my fingers into the dirt to try to loosen its grip. Helen cries out, as if it's some part of her I'm trying to loosen. Please, Mum, not the coissia. Dad and I planted that, and you always say it smells lovely.
I leave the shrub alone. Here by the gate is a box of glass things. Those things for drinking and jams. They are all open, and for the taking. And although I can't think why you'd want one, I reach in, the glass ringing and squeaking. One has Branston Pickle on the label, and I get a sudden vision of Elizabeth's dining room, of salad cream and white pepper and majolica plates hung on the walls, of ceramic lizards and turtles and stag beetles scrabbling from ferns and grasses towards the ceiling, of Elizabeth laughing at my disgust when she brings out a teapot with its spout shaped like a snake. I cradle the jar in my arms. It still has its lid, though many of its brothers don't, and I have to unscrew it to drop in the thing for hair that I've got in my pocket. A ring thing to tie up your hair. It's wet, as if it's been on the ground, and there's a broken polo mint stuck to it. And I've got a little plastic frog here, too. They all go in together. On the edge of the pavement is a snail slowly suckering along, and I prize it from the ground as a woman with a long black ponytail comes out of my house. Her hair thing is just like the one in my jar. "I've put the medication on a plate," she says, "but I really have to get to my next lady now." "I know," Helen says. "Thank you. Thank you for calling me." The woman stops by a small, roundish car. "Will you be all right?" She isn't talking to me. I drop the snail into the jar and watch as it bubbles its juices against the glass. "I can make my own majolica ware."
"Yes," Helen says. "I'll just stay with her. You'll have to call someone else if..."
"I know.
Thanks."
The woman looks back at the lawn.
"At least you know about plants, so you can put it right later, maybe."
Helen laughs, not very happily, and the woman gets into the car and drives off. I walk in the same direction, going into other front gardens, gathering things, masses of things. A bottle top, a plastic cameo brooch, a beetle lying with its legs in the air, a handful of sand, and some cigarette ends. I put them in the pickle jar and shake, catching sight of the name Branston over and over. And I think of Elizabeth over and over, and it's like a pain pulsing through my skin with every heartbeat. I could see Helen, two houses back, watching as I sink my hand into a mound of sand piled up by a fence. Someone is cementing over their garden. Elizabeth's son is always threatening to do that. How horrid that would be. What a terrible thing. "No birds will come," I told her. "It will be like a desert." And how would we ever get at the ground underneath? It would be lost forever. I walk past the ugly house and the tea dregs and the acacia, the way I've always walked, and then further on until I can hear the sound of trains. I stare hollowly across the street. On the opposite side is the station hotel. It's an old people's home now, and I read the name aloud, Cotland's Care Home. It's a tall Victorian building, still stately, even with its change of purpose. The care home sign is loose on its screws. They seem to have been pushed out by the brick, as if the old building were rejecting its new title. I remember when I was young how it seemed to bristle at the smears of coal dust over its stone front. I always stared at it in those days. It's where Suki's suitcase was found. I'd been there once before, just after the case arrived on our kitchen table. I'd gone to stand against the railings of the station, staring at the dozens of windows,
and wondering what Suki had been doing in a hotel in her own town. Wondering if she was somehow still living there, hoping she might look out and see me and come running. Of course she didn't, and I went home to another silent dinner. But finding the letter again, reading it, and having the word lover jostling next to Douglas's name inside my head made me think more sharply. A hotel. Wasn't that the very place people went to have affairs? Hadn't I seen that a dozen times at the pictures? And so I made my way back there one lunchtime instead of going home, stooping to pick up a discarded ticket stub as I went through the doors. Inside, the hotel seemed to be just one long staircase, winding round and round, as if the people who stayed there didn't do enough travelling. From the bottom, it looked like a well, like the rabbit hole in Alice in Wonderland. I thought Suki could easily have fallen down it and never found her way back. And I walked up slowly, looking down at the station from the windows, at railway passengers and porters with laden carts. The scent of onion soup drifted up from the hotel kitchens, mixing with the smell of the acrid banister polish. The combination made me feel strangely hungry, and I felt in my pocket for a carrot biscuit, knowing I had none, and finding only the ticket stub and Suki's slow-roasted letter again. Every now and then a non-stopping train would hurtle through the station and cause a whirl of steam to fly up above the building, and I lingered at the top landing to watch as the paperboy struggled to hold on to his wares and his hat. Along the corridor the numbered doors were shut, and I couldn't bring myself to try the handles, so I squinted in the dim light at the worn carpet and peeling wallpaper. Had Suki and Douglas met here? Had they whispered to each other? Exchanged kisses? It seemed so unlikely. And yet I couldn't help a stabbing jealousy at the possibility that I'd been left out of it all, not trusted with the truth. I picked at a piece of wallpaper, curled over itself by the light switch, tearing it carefully away from the plaster and putting it into my pocket. On the way back to the stairs, a man passed me. He opened a door, and I caught a glimpse of someone inside. She had soft, dark hair and a blue suit neatly fitted to her figure. Something coiled fast and tight inside me, and I stared, hardly hearing the man as he spoke.
"Get back from the door, will you?"
he said, his eyes too big for their lids. I didn't move, couldn't even swallow. But I took him in now, thin and dusty-looking, his slight frame hardly able to block my view into the room. And then the woman turned. But her nose was heavier than I expected, her lips fleshier, her cheeks flatter, and the coil became a lump in my stomach. I fell back against the wall. "What on earth's the matter?" the woman said, coming out and taking my wrist, her fingers plumply pressing at my pulse. "Looks like she's seen a ghost." At the woman's voice, the man seemed to shake off his dust and his eyes fitted better into their sockets.
"Lord help us, girl," he said. "Who gave us a fright looking in like that? What is it? Don't like my face?"
I withdrew my wrist from the woman's hand and slinked away to sit at the top of the stairs, listening to the station guardsmen make announcements on the wind. I couldn't find the energy to get up, so I lay back, my legs extending the length of the short flight, and let the rumble of trains vibrate through me. I made a study of the sand that had been trodden into the carpet, imagining I could taste sea salt on the air, until the woman from the room discovered me.
"You again?" she said, doing a little two-step of surprise as she reached the landing above. "What are you lying there for? Are you hurt?"
"Not really,"
I told her, getting up. "Are you a guest?"
"No. I just came in. Sorry."
"Just came in to lie on the stairs?"
She began to walk down past me, and I followed.
"No, it's just... I thought you were someone else."
"Who did you think I was?"
I didn't answer,
and she asked me if I thought I was in shock.
"Oh, no, I am," she said.
I told her I supposed I might be, and she suggested I have a small glass of brandy.
"I'm having one at any rate."
She left me in the hallway while she went into the bar. This wasn't the Five Ways, and they'd never tolerate a girl in there.
"Poor thing, came in to have a shock,"
I heard her say, catching glimpses of the blue suit through the swing doors as people went in and out. Even after seeing her face, I couldn't help but imagine she was Suki. She pointed towards the foyer, and several men turned to look at me. One of them was Frank. He saw me, of course, and a moment later was pushing the bar door open. I'd hardly thought of him until that moment, and had only imagined what Suki and Douglas might have been to each other. I felt a sharp pain on Frank's behalf, the pain he might have felt if he'd known about them. And then I wondered if he did know, if Suki had told him, like she'd said she was going to in the letter. I remembered the way he'd spoken about Douglas, calling him a rat-faced idiot, and that made me think he did know. And what did that mean? What might he have done if he'd found out? I couldn't face him and turned to run back into the stairwell.
"Maud," he called after me.
"Oh, Frank," I heard the woman say.
"Is she with you?"
I rushed up the stairs higgly-piggly, turning and turning until my thighs burned, and I was back at the top landing, looking for the runs of sand in the steps' creases. Frank had started on the first flight and then given up. I saw his face appear between two landings directly below me as he leant backwards over the handrail.
"Come down here, will you?" he said, his voice spiralling up after me. "I can't be doing with these bloody stairs."
"What are you doing here?" I asked, sending the words down through the floors.
"Having a drink." "Having a drink? Not a crime, is it?"
"But why here? Where her suitcase was found?"
"You're talking about Suki, aren't you?"
"Of course I'm talking about Suki. Who else would I be talking about?"
"All right. What was the other bit?"
I realized he was what Dad would call tight, and so I repeated my words slowly. "Suki's suitcase was found here." He opened his mouth but looked away as the woman came to the bottom of the stairs, a glass in her hand.
"Want to come down and have this, then?" she said, her voice echoing.
I did want it. The liquid was honey-coloured, and I imagined it would be sweet and warming, and that I might somehow learn something from drinking it. But I'd never had spirits before. "I'm not sure I ought to," I said.
"Suit yourself."
She knocked the whole thing back before disappearing again into the bar. I was disappointed, and it was only years later that I finally tasted brandy for the first time, and the burning unpleasantness made me glad I hadn't bothered that day. "How does that woman know your name?" I asked Frank.
"Oh, Nancy? She works here. Her husband's an ex-POW. Poor bastard. Touched, he is. Can't bear to live at home, so they live here. I gave them some bits of furniture a while back to make it more homely."
I laughed. It was Dad's,
I might have known, laugh.
"Seems there's hardly a person in the town you haven't done some sort of favour for."
"That's a bit of a push," Frank said. "Who else have I done favours for that you know of?"
"People on your street?"
"Who wouldn't do their neighbours a good turn if they could?"
"It's why you did the favours that I wonder about."
"What's got into you?"
he asked. His head disappeared a moment, and his hand slid up the banister. I wanted him to stop, to stay where he was and not come any closer. I needed to think, to unmuddle my head, to remember the questions I most wanted to ask. I thought about running to the POW's room. "Does she work at the desk?" I said. "Nancy?"
Is she the one that wrote Suki's name in the register?
What are you talking about, Maudie?
Frank asked, just a hand on polished wood, slowly following the curve of the stairs. His voice curled towards me, sinister and momentous, without a body, and I felt the banister like a conductor, sending a current of electricity from his hand to mine.
What are you doing here? Did you come to find me?
No!
But you're angry with me.
The hand disappeared, and he took the few remaining flights at a run. They weren't too much for him, after all.
What is it? What's happened? You've discovered something?
I stepped back, disturbed at having to look up at him instead of down, and crumpled the letter in my pocket in answer.
What have you got there?
He asked with a half-smile, as if I were a child playing a game. A letter?
From who?
Suki. She sent it before she disappeared. I had expected a conversation. I thought he'd ask what the letter said, that I'd have time to question him. But I didn't even see his expression change before he lunged at me. With a single movement, I found I was bent back over the banister and he was trapping me there with one hand on my collarbone. The sudden strength of him was a shock. I squeezed my fist around the letter and pushed deep into my pocket, the fabric grazing my skin. He gripped my wrist and tried to jerk it upwards, dragging my skirt up with it. "The letter says she was going to tell you something," I said, clamping my arm to my side, determined to ask my questions anyway. "Did she tell you something?"
"Give me the letter, Maud."
His hand slid over my elbow, forcing it to bend, and my arm rose helplessly. "Tell me," I said, trying to hang on to my thoughts, to remember what I was supposed to be asking. It seemed odd to be talking still when I was so like a rag doll in his hands.
"How can I when I haven't read it?"
He had clenched his teeth and was twisting my arm back, his skin hot through the material of my school blouse. That moment, I scrunched the letter into a ball and dropped it over the banister, the way you drop a penny down a well. Frank swore as it fell and tried to snatch it from the air. The action forced me further over the banisters and my feet left the floor. I tried to catch at the handrail but missed. Sickness rushed up as I felt the ground far below do the same. And then Frank's hands were on me again. He pulled me roughly onto the landing, and it took a moment before I realized I was safe, not falling. When I looked, his face was white.
"Thought I'd lost you," he said.
And it was unnerving to see how thoroughly the blood had drained from his skin.
"I thought I'd lost you."
He made light grabs at my limbs, like an incompetent doctor checking for broken bones. He seemed to have to prove to himself I was really there. "Don't worry. I'm not a ghost," I said, though my heart was still beating so hard it was difficult to draw breath. And I wonder what my face had looked like when he touched me. He hung over the banister, and his shirt clung to him, showing the muscles in his shoulders and back. I took a step towards him. He breathed out heavily and started down the stairs.
"No. Stay where you are," he said. "I can't be trusted."
I stood for a moment, listening to his footsteps as they descended. The blood that had been rushing around my head slowed, leaving the beginnings of a headache. And I let myself imagine, once, what it would have been like if Frank hadn't stopped me falling. I felt the way my head might have caved in, and how my neck would have crumpled. I pictured blood on the tiled floor and people screaming. I thought of my parents, already suffering from Suki's absence, and I guessed at what might have happened to Frank. He'd have been accused of pushing me, surely. Halfway down the stairs he stopped, and his face appeared again between the floors.
"Tell me something about Suki, Maud," he said. "Not about this place. Tell me something else."
"What, for instance?"
"I don't know.
Something you did together? That you remember?
I scuffed my shoe over the sand-sodden carpet.
We went to the beach, I said, beginning to walk down after him. The day they removed the barbed wire. That was before you were married. Before the war was even over.
I know. Go on.
And I buried her in the sand.
My voice echoed off the walls strangely as I followed him down, but I could still hear the way she'd laughed that day, and see the sand slipping over itself, streaming into the crevices. And I pushed shells into the sand to make her a dress. And afterwards, when she dug her way out, she shook her hair. Her ma was cross because she got sand on the sandwiches, and when we ate them later, they were full of grit. But the shell dress was really brilliant, I said, reaching the bottom of the stairs.
Suki made me collect white ones for the skirt, so it would look like it had a petticoat. I wish we'd had a camera.
I wish you had too, he said,
pulling the collar of my blouse closed around my neck.
Get home now, Maudie, he said. I'm going for another drink.
He bent to pick up the browned and crumpled letter, slipping it into his pocket as he walked away.
Come and stand here, Mum.
I'm wobbling on my feet. It has started to rain and someone's cigarette smoke lingers in the air. Helen is cowering under a bus shelter. She stands right back against the seat as I get near and seems not to be breathing. I put a hand up to her face, and she screws her eyes shut for a second, raising an arm. There's a livid mark on her wrist that looks like it will bruise. How did you get this? I say, taking her wrist as gently as I can, feeling her pulse strong and quick.
It doesn't matter, she says.
It matters to me. You're my daughter. If you're hurt, it matters to me. I love you very much.
She stares at me for a moment, and I worry I haven't used the right words, and then I feel a sudden exhaustion. My limbs won't hold me up. I'm like one of those toys that flop over when you press the bottom in. The wire in my joints has uncoiled. But Helen's hands are under my arms, and I find the seat beneath me. I try to settle the glass pickle jar on my lap, but I can't get it to stay put. The seat is at an angle, and either I or the jar keeps sliding off. The contents jumble, and something moves, oozily covering the frog's eye. It's irritating. I turn to say something to the woman who's sitting next to me, but tears are running down her cheeks.
There, there, dear, I say.
She sobs and presses the back of her hand to her mouth.
I don't know what to do to help her. I can't work out who she is.
Tell me what the matter is, I say. I'm sure it can't be bad as all that.
I pat her shoulder, wondering how I got here.
I don't remember getting the bus.
Perhaps I'm on the way back from some appointment.
But I can't think what it would be.
Is it man trouble? I say.
She looks at me again and smiles, though she's definitely still crying.
He been unfaithful? I ask. He'll be back. Pretty girl like you.
Though in actual fact you couldn't call her a girl.
It's not a man, she says.
I look at her in surprise.
Woman, is it?
She frowns at me and gets up to look at the bus timetable. Perhaps she thought I was prying.
Two pigeons nod at each other on the branch of a tree.
They seem like me and this woman, chatting to each other, as if they are our bird selves. I try to wave at them, but I have to be quick to catch the jar from sliding off my lap.
When the woman turns back, I look at her face properly. The tears have been wiped away,
It's Helen. The seat seems to tilt under me. It's my daughter, Helen. I've been sitting in a bus shelter with her, not knowing who she was. Helen, I say, touching her wrist, noticing a dark mark on it. Helen. I didn't know my own daughter. You're exhausted, she says. You can't walk back. I'm going to go and get the car. Okay, Mum? My stomach seems to have dissolved inside me. I didn't know my own daughter. And it feels like a reproach to hear her call me Mum. I scrabble about in the jar for something to do. There's a bit of mint stuck to a hairband, and I nibble the edge. But it doesn't taste right, and there's some sort of grit on it. An old woman comes towards the bus stop.
"Hello, dear," she says, sitting and rummaging in her bag.
"Hello," I say. I notice she has tatty carpet slippers on. She must be even dottier than me. Helen says hello, too. "I have to run and get my car," she says. "Would you mind keeping an eye on my mum? It'll only take me a few minutes." She looks over at the timetable with a frown. "You won't let her get on a bus?" The woman agrees, uncurling a bit of plastic inside the bag. Helen pauses on the curb, biting her top lip, and then begins to leap between the cars, waving back at me.
"Taking you out for the day, is she?" the woman says, unscrewing the lid from a bottle and taking a long drink. "Wish someone would take me out."
She jerks a hand behind her. There's a stone building with a sign hanging from its facade. "Cotland's Care Home," I read. "That's it." The woman's hair is in tight white curls, very neat. They don't match the tatty slippers.
"My son asked me to come here. Said it was for the best. I'd be closer to him. He'd be less worried. He could come and visit more, take me for drives in the country. But does he?"
She shakes her curls. "And so I'm stuck here."
"Oh, the carers aren't bad people. From somewhere foreign, but very kind. Smile all the time. But so tiny. I feel I've dropped into Lilliput, you know. And I'm only 5'2".
She takes another swig from her bottle, and the sound of her swallowing is comforting. She drinks with a focus that makes me think of Frank and the sweaty heat of a pub, and I expect to look down and see my bare knees. But I've got trousers on, and a jar of jumbled things in my lap.
"And after a while in there, you lose yourself. I can't remember what I like or dislike any more. They say, 'Mrs. Mapp doesn't like peas,' or 'Mrs. Mapp loves starburst.' And then they ask, 'That's right, isn't it, dear?' And I nod. But I can't for the life of me remember what peas taste like. And I've no idea what a starburst is. Same with TV. They put something on and they say, 'Like this, do you?' And I nod. But I couldn't tell you what the bloody hell it's about."
I look back towards the care home. There's something in that jumble of words, something important, but I can't grasp onto it. A tiny brown lady is coming out of the gates, and worse than that is my name. It's Margaret, by the way. Margaret. "Nice to meet you, Margaret." She shakes her curls again.
"Yes, yes, you too. But you see, in there they insist on calling me Peggy. Peggy. I hate that name."
"Me too," I say, thinking of the charity shop.
"Peggy, you no get bus now?" the small brown lady calls, smiling.
"I know that," Peggy says. "I'm only having a chat."
"Here, quick,
she says to me, throwing the bottle into my lap where it clinks against the pickle jar.
Can't get caught with this. Would get a right old lecture.
Pity, because gin's the only thing I know I like.
Inside, please, Peggy,
the little woman says. See what I mean? Peggy this, Peggy that. Bloody nightmare. They even put it on my records. So now I'm Peggy Mapp, not Margaret Mapp.
They put it on your records, I say, and feel a little jolt.
Yes. If you called and asked for Margaret, they'd probably say I didn't live here. Half of them don't know my real name.
She pauses to sigh.
You see, there was another Margaret when I first got here, and they wanted to make sure they didn't get us confused. She's dropped dead since, of course. But I'm still Peggy.
I watch her go in with a tiny carer, and the bus arrives. I'm about to get on when there's a shout from across the road. The driver calls out of his window to someone.
There's a great to-do over something, and the doors fold shut.
Helen is here too,
talking, talking, but I can't concentrate on what she's saying. I'm thinking of all the different names there are for Elizabeth. Eliza, Lizzie, Liz, Lisa, Betty, Betsy, Bet, Beth, Bess, Bessie.
Chapter 14. What about this, Mum? Do you want this? Keep packing. Just look quickly.
The white glare from the window softens as Helen holds something up in her hands.
I can't see what.
It's a shadow, a vague shape. I turn my head, trying another angle, but it stays vague.
I don't know what that is,
I say, dropping the sleeved thing. The buttoned and sleeved thing I've been trying to fold, and putting a hand back to press a knuckle against my spine.
I'm uncomfortable sitting like this, twisted round on my bed, but I can't see anywhere else to sit.
There's a suitcase at my feet, and we're surrounded by the musty smell of clothes left too long in a wardrobe.
It's like the charity shop in here, I say.
Are we going on holiday?
Helen drops her hands and the white light from the window makes me blink.
No, Mum.
Because I don't think I can go on holiday. I think it would be too much for me.
I think I'd rather just stay at home.
You're moving house, remember? You're moving in with me.
Oh, yes, I say. Of course.
Of course. That's what all the boxes are for. I fold the jumble of sleeves and buttons, whatever they add up to, that are lying on the bed, laying them in a suitcase and throwing a pair of knickers on top.
Are we going on?
I remember in time and stop myself, but Helen still sighs. She toes something across the floor.
Do you need that? She asks.
It's a pickle jar. There are things squeezed inside. A glove, breathing dampness onto the inside of the glass. Two bottle tops, a Kit Kat wrapper, some cigarette ends spilling the last of their tobacco.
That's important, I say.
How can it be important? It's disgusting.
She picks it up with the tips of her fingers and peers at the things before tossing it with a heavy, dangerous clink onto one of the piles of clothes.
The jar rolls down the slope of fabric, sending the sand inside whirling about like one of those snow shakers they sell at Christmas. I pull it onto a sheet of newspaper to wrap, but the metal lid pierces through the first layer, and I have to wrap another round it. Helen rolls her eyes.
Oh, Helen, I say, pressing pleats of paper over the word pickle. If I move, how will Elizabeth know where I am?
I'll tell Peter, Helen says. I'll tell him to pass the message on. I'll do it tomorrow. I explore the jar's contours with my fingers, watching her piling things out of a cupboard. You'll tell Peter? She nods, not looking at me. How will that help, Helen? I say. He won't tell Elizabeth. He won't tell her anything. He's done something to her. I don't know what. Hidden her away, or worse. She's gone, and I don't know where. Okay, Mum, okay, she says. What about this? It's a ceramic spoon shaped like the head of a cow. The handle of the spoon has been made to look like the cow's tongue. It's very ugly. Yes, yes, I need that, I say, reaching for it. It's for Elizabeth. I find a piece of newspaper and scrunch it round the cow's head. The printed words are cut in half by the creases in the paper. I try to read them, but they don't make sense. I don't think they make sense. Elizabeth, again! You've chucked most of Dad's stuff in the blink of an eye, but you're desperate to keep all this crap, even though half of it doesn't mean anything to you. I feel something filling my chest and grip the cow spoon tightly in my hands. The newspaper splits. I can keep what I want, can't I? I don't see what it's got to do with you. You're moving into my house. So it's your rules, is it? And I have to do as you say? I don't think I want to live with you if it's going to be like this. Well, there's no choice now. The house is sold. For a moment, I can't make sense of the words. It seems an impossible sentence. You've sold my house? I say, feeling sick. The floor I'm sitting on seems not to be quite stable, as if it's gone already. How can you sell my house? It's mine. I live here. I've always lived here. Oh, Mum, you agreed months ago. It's not safe for you to live on your own any more. Can you keep packing, please? I'll get you a cup of tea in a minute. Who agreed? You've no right. You and me and Tom agreed. Tom? I say the name. I know it's someone particular, but I can't think who. Yes, Tom. Does that make it all right now if he agreed too? Tom, I say, looking about at the piles of clothes. Is that the man we're giving all these things to? He flies in from Germany once a year and flies out again, and you think he's wonderful. But he's not here day after day, arranging your appointments and talking to your carers, checking your cupboards and taking you out shopping, buying you new underwear every time you lose yours and picking you up from police stations at 2 o'clock in the morning. She keeps talking. She doesn't stop when I ask her to. She stares at the things in her hands and recites something. It sounds like a list of some kind. I wonder if I should be writing it down, and I reach for some paper. I write Tom, but it comes out funny. The paper isn't flat and the pen slips over the ridges of whatever is underneath. I can't think what the word means anyway. I take a hand mirror from a table and put it on another bit of newspaper. When I look at it closely, I can see an eye staring back at me. Oh, I say. Is it something to do with the madwoman? Helen turns to me. What? I point at the mirror, whispering, Is she hiding in here? Helen stares but doesn't answer. And I can't think what I was asking her anyway. The questions have lost their definiteness, tangled amongst the cobwebs in my head. I yawn and put a newspaper package on the floor next to another similar one. They are strange, muffled shapes, and I push them away.
There's something frightening about their facelessness.
That must be what my thoughts look like, masked and unrecognizable.
I search for something else to wrap.
Helen, who are we giving these things to?
She closes a suitcase and snaps the clasp shut. The noise, the sharp secret-breaking noise, makes me think of another case, and of my mother standing at the kitchen table, and of my father turning his face to the fire.
"We got her case back," I say to Helen, though she's already on the stairs. "But there was nothing in it. It was just full of newspaper." Something tells me this is wrong, that I'm mixing it up. But I can see the bits of paper floating, rustling out of Suki's case, covering the kitchen floor. "I remember it so clearly," I say, getting the case back from the police and opening the lid, and there it was, full of newspaper. I'm sure that's how it was. I follow Helen to the front door and stand, pushing a hand into the coisea bush, while she goes to the car and lifts in the suitcase. It's a heavy thing, one of those hard ones for taking on planes. I only used it a few times when I was still able to visit Tom in Germany. "Are we going on holiday?" I say. Helen slams the boot shut and walks back to the house. When I get upstairs, she's manoeuvring my matchbox chest out of the wardrobe. I made this when I was a child. 100 tiny boxes all joined together with glue, which has yellowed and crackles now between the cardboard. I used to store my collection of shells in the drawers, and bits of broken pottery, and insects, and feathers. And useful things, too, like thread and pins. Suki was always opening the wrong box, wanting a button or a needle, and she'd scream on seeing the furry body of a bumblebee or a tiger moth lying in its bed of newspaper. She complained, but I had a feeling she enjoyed the fright of it. "I thought I'd thrown these away," I say. "Are we going to go through them all?" "I'd rather just chuck them," she says, though her hands hover over the boxes as if she's trying to decide which one to open first.
"But Helen, what if there's something I want in there?
You know, I used to collect matchboxes when I was a child."
"I know, Mum. And we used to find dead insects in them when we were children.
Your secrets, we called them. Boxes full of disintegrating bees and wasps and beetles.
Yes, I collected those too."
"Was that you?" I say. "Was it you who screamed?"
"It was probably Tom."
She starts to pull out all the little drawers, leaning away as if something might spring at her. "Do you want these old feathers? This button?"
She tugs at a drawer near the bottom, and I have a sudden tightening in my stomach.
"Piece of old wallpaper," she says, shaking the little drawer. "And a bit of a fingernail.
Ooh! What do you have that for?"
She passes me the drawer, but it seems only half there. I can see the bottom of a tea chest more clearly. Fluffy balls of dust gathered in the corners where the newspaper lining has wrinkled away. And the fingernail is nestled amongst the dust and odd bits of different coloured threads, pearly and splintered, like a broken shell. And when I look up, Frank is there. I didn't really expect to see him again after the time in the hotel. I tried to talk to Ma about him, but Dad said he didn't want the name mentioned in his house. And that was that, until nearly a week later, when I found him making another dent in the hedge at the end of our road.
"Been waiting near on an hour," he said,
as if I was late.
"What time did you finish school?"
He looked smarter,
His hair was slicked neatly into place under his hat like it used to be, and he'd had a shave.
"I got held back," I said, "not concentrating in class."
He walked to the edge of the pavement.
"Which class was it?"
"Don't know," I said, making him laugh. I pulled the branches of the hedge through my fingers, careful not to knock any leaves off, and then took a step towards my house.
"I'd ask you in," I said.
"Yeah, I know. But I'm not welcome."
He followed me home anyway, glancing at the sitting room windows before throwing his cigarette into the front garden.
"Actually, I was going to ask you to come and see me. There's something I want you to have."
"Now?" I asked, not sure I wanted to go anywhere with him after last time.
He shrugged, nodded, and I looked at him for a moment. His gaze was very steady, and when he smiled at me, narrowing his eyes and adjusting his hat, I found I was smiling back without thinking.
"I'll have to tell them something," I said.
I ran down the path to the back door and waited in the kitchen for a few minutes, checking that Ma hadn't left anything in the range for dinner. She and Dad had gone to London to find out if Suki had been seen. Dad thought it was likely that Frank had taken her there and lied about it. Ma thought Suki might have gone to find Frank and missed him somehow. Douglas said he was going to the pictures, but he'd said that several times recently and then hadn't seemed to be able to recall what it was he'd watched. So who knew where he really was? Either way, I didn't want Frank to know that there was no one at home to miss me. He was at the end of the street when I came out, looking into the park. It was only then that I realized how gloomy the evening was. The red of the bricks was fading, and the pine trees were black above our heads. It was dinner time, and we walked through empty streets, passing the laundry with its hot, clean scent, like a fierce cuddle. Frank stuck a cigarette in his mouth, taking a box of matches from his pocket and rattling it.
"Last one,"
he said, sliding the tray out. He struck the match and flicked it into the street.
"Want the box?" he asked. "Collect them, don't you?"
"I did," I said, "when I was younger." I took the box and slipped it into the pocket of my skirt, feeling shy and irritated. I didn't like being reminded of how recently I'd been a child. I felt he was mocking me.
"What do you collect them for?"
he asked. "I don't know. To put things in, I suppose. Like I say, it was just something I did when I was a kid."
"To put things in, eh? Secret things, would they be?"
"No, just bits and pieces, spare buttons. Nothing important." He looked down at me and smiled, as if he knew better, and I blushed and felt guilty, asking myself if I was hiding something without knowing it.
"I wonder what sort of secrets a girl like you would have."
"I don't have any secrets," I said.
"Don't want to tell me, eh, Maudie? But perhaps you will. One day."
He kept grinning, not noticing that I wasn't smiling back. I didn't know what to say. I was annoyed at not being believed, but also strangely pleased. I think I liked the idea of having secrets. When we got to the house, he waited so that I had to go up the front steps ahead of him, and he unlocked the front door by reaching past me. I stared at the key in the lock as his breath lifted strands of my hair.